Welcome to Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. James Beard said, "Too few people understand a really good sandwich." Well, we do. We'll talk about what makes a great sandwich and take a look at some non-traditional examples. Then we'll consider some other iconic American foods. So, let's dig in. Kevin Weeks is a personal chef in Knoxville, Tennessee. He also teaches cooking classes and blogs at Seriously Good. He has written about sandwiches for Kitchen Window Online and joins me today. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Bonnie. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Oh, excellent.
So you've written a story about sandwiches. And
oh, yeah. They are so underappreciated.
Do you think so? I think that they've become sort of trendy.
I think people tend to take them for granted and don't realize what a wonderful meal they are.
Well, you have a rather broad definition of sandwich.
Well, that's true.
How would you define a sandwich?
A sandwich needs to be something you can eat with your hands. And the other is it needs to be enclosed in some sort of bread. And that bread can be sliced bread, or it can be a pastry, such as in the case of a Cornish pasty or a calzone or an empanada.
Well, let's talk first about the traditional sandwich,
okay.
Which is, in your piece for Kitchen Window, you say that the bread is very important and that people often, you come to the bread as kind of an afterthought.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely essential. I discovered the importance of bread when I started making my own pizza dough, and it just totally changed the character of the pizza. And about the same time, I started also making bread and found that it really changed the character of my sandwiches.
Now, do I have to make my own bread to have a decent sandwich?
Well, you don't have to. I enjoy baking bread, and so I don't mind doing it. But these days, you can find good bread at the specialty bakers. And most towns now have a dedicated bakery somewhere.
Now, do you have any guidance on when to use white bread, when to use whole wheat bread, rye bread?
Not particularly. I do like the traditions. I like rye bread with ham, but I like a rye grilled cheese sandwich.
Oh, that sounds good. How do you make a really good grilled cheese sandwich?
Well, first off, my favorite bread for grilled cheese is James Beard's sourdough white, because it has a very open sort of crumb, and yet it's dense enough to do well on a grill. Then you butter both sides of it. Put one side down, butter side down, in a cold cast iron skillet.
Mm-hmm.
Put several slices, and I like the Grafton cheddar cheese.
That's Vermont.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Several slices of that, about 3/8 of an inch thick.
Ooh.
And then top it with the other slice of bread, and turn the heat to medium low.
Okay.
And cook it until the bottom is brown, and that'll take you about 5 to 6 to 7 minutes, depending. And during that time, and this is the great thing about that particular bread, is because of the open crumb, the cheese soaks down into the bread.
Mm.
And then you flip it over, and the cheese soaks down into the bread while you brown off the other side, and you get this, oh, it's an amazingly good grilled cheese sandwich with cheese just distributed throughout it, hot melted cheese. Mm.
It sounds fabulous. I'm drooling. Let's go to some of the other things that you include in your sandwich definitions. You mentioned Cornish pasties. Tell us a little bit about that.
One of my absolute favorites. Traditionally, they were made in Cornwall in England for the miners. A pasty is a turnover type thing. It's made with a pastry crust, and it's filled with meat and potatoes and whatever else you might have around. And then they're baked, and the idea was they carry this, wrapped in a handkerchief, they carry this pasty down into the mines with them. And then during their lunch break, they open it up, they can eat the pasty, holding on to one corner of it to avoid getting coal dust on the rest of it. And they get to the very end, and they've got this one dirty corner of pasty left, and they discard that.
And yeah. I've made them. They're not that hard.
No, they're not. They're wonderful both hot and cold, and so they make a great picnic food.
And an empanada is quite similar to a pasty.
Mm-hmm. A Spanish take on it, a Latin take on it.
What would be in a Spanish empanada? What would the filling be?
My favorite recipe uses pork. But fish is also not unusual on feast days.
Really? Calzone is yet another sort of version of...
Well, a calzone is essentially a pizza folded in half and sealed. So again, it looks like a turnover. It's usually made with pizza dough, which is a risen dough. And you fill it with the sorts of things you would ordinarily put in a pizza, put on a pizza, and seal it over and then bake it. And again, it's a great one-handed sort of meal.
What are some of your other favorite sandwiches encased in pastry or in bread?
Probably my absolute favorite sandwich is a good Reuben.
And how do you make a Reuben?
You've got to have a good rye bread. This is one where I frequently make my own bread. I like very thinly sliced corned beef, piled high. The common condiment on a Reuben is Thousand Island dressing, and I make my own sort of version of that. It's slightly sweet, which stands it very nicely against the tartness of the sauerkraut, which also goes on a Reuben.
What gives the dressing the sweetness? Pickles?
Pickles, right, and a little bit of ketchup.
Huh, okay.
And then you brush it with, spread it with butter, and again, grill it like you would a grilled cheese. Oh, and I also usually add a good Swiss to it, something like a Jarlsberg.
And you cook it the same way you would your grilled cheese sandwich?
Exactly.
Wow. How often do you eat a sandwich?
Oh, I eat at least a couple of sandwiches a week, and they're often for supper.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, they're substantial sandwiches. And you think about it, you've got some sort of vegetable in there usually. It could be lettuce, tomatoes, sauerkraut, pickles. You've got bread, which is a carbohydrate. There's usually some sort of protein in the form of meat and cheese. You've got dairy and the cheese. I mean, it's a really a complete meal in one very neat package.
Well, Kevin, this has been very illuminating and very enticing, and I thank you so much.
Sure, go make a sandwich.
That was Chef Kevin Weeks. Okay, but have you ever heard of a mother-in-law sandwich? John T. Edge is the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, and Bruce Craig is president of the Culinary Historians of Chicago. They give NPR's Debbie Elliott the lowdown.
Think of a Chicago hot dog, a prototypical Chicago hot dog with that poppy seed bun, some sport peppers, relish that is of a color not found in nature, bright green. Think about that prototypical hot dog, but substitute a corn roll tamale instead of the Vienna beef, and you've got a mother-in-law sandwich.
Any idea where this name came from?
No. In fact, John T. and I were going around talking to landowners and to the manufacturers, and we heard all kinds of stories.
My favorite was this guy at John's G.A.R., which is a hot dog stand just down the street, about a block away from Tom Tom Tamales. And he said, well, it's got a fierce bite, just like a mother-in-law. I thought, he has bad family life.
Now, your theory is that this sandwich has its roots in the Mississippi Delta?
It's a working theory, Debbie. I think about this idea that when African-Americans left the Mississippi Delta in the early years of the 20th century, they brought their music with them, and what was rural country blues became electric blues in the bars of Chicago. And I wonder, and I'm just wondering, if that's what happened to tamales, which are a primary snack food of the Mississippi Delta, especially among African Americans, if when they came north, they brought tamales, and tamales and Chicago-style hot dogs had a baby, and that baby's the mother-in-law.
There is, though, this huge Mexican population in Chicago, so that could be explanation as well.
But also, cornmeal is a staple of diets in Illinois. And if you look at restaurant menus, for example, from the 1850s right through this period, 1890s to 1900, you'll actually find cornmeal mush on them.
So let's just review here. I've got a hot dog bun with a tamale in the middle, maybe some chili or some peppers or some relish on top. That just sounds, well, I don't know what it sounds like. I can't imagine what it tastes like. What does this taste like?
It tastes like mush. The texture is awful. And if you want an instant carbohydrate rush, this is it. You can't beat it.
John T., you agree?
Mr. Craig obviously possesses a more refined palate than I. I happen to love the mother-in-law. I think that, you know, and I see poor folks' food. I see inventive poor folks' food, and I taste inventive poor folks' food when I taste a mother-in-law. I like the kind of creaminess mixing with the grittiness of the cornmeal in the tamale at the core, and that kind of jolt of heat that comes with the sport pepper.
Thank you both for talking with us.
It was fun, Debbie.
Thank you.
You're wrong, Bruce.
Bruce Craig is the president of the Culinary Historians of Chicago. John T. Edge is the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance at the University of Mississippi.
NPR's Debbie Elliott goes back to John T. Edge, director of the Southern Foodways Alliance.
So your book on hamburgers, it's much more than a cookbook. I would say it's almost a manifesto.
There's a bit of righteous indignation in the face of things like, I don't know, tofu burgers, yes. There's a bit of a Jeremiah in the book.
So as you're traveling around the country, many of the towns that you visit claim to be the place where burger meets bun.
They do, and I think a lot of that's kind of provincial bluster, and I admire it. Really, there's about four. There's Seymour, Wisconsin, where local folks say that in 1885, Charlie Nagrin, who at that time is 15, slipped a meatball between two slices of bread and dubbed it a hamburger. Another story is told is from Oklahoma. It's got Oscar Bilby, and his great-grandson still runs a drive-in in Tulsa. They claim, the Bilby family claims, that this came from a 4th of July picnic in 1891. Fletcher Davis of Athens, Texas, claims that the adherents of his story claim that in 1904 the burger was introduced to the demi-monde at the St. Louis World's Fair. And then there's Louis Lunch in New Haven, Connecticut, where they claim in 1900 that they first cooked the hamburger as we know it. All of the stories have some shred of truth, but what I think you can take from this is all of this is happening. All these stories are told in the late 1800s, early 1900s. As America becomes a more urban culture, it's something we embrace. As Americans move from the farm to factory jobs, it's something that can be eaten quick, on the go. It's a food that came to matter to Americans at just the time they needed it.
And everybody seems to think that the very best burger is in their little town.
Yeah, and that's what's so beautiful about this. There's, I'll defer to Calvin Trillin, as I should, in all things gastronomic and literary. Trillin once wrote, and I'm paraphrasing, "Anyone who doesn't think their hometown hamburger is the best is a sissy." and there's this pride of place in that. You know, if you ask where to find the best slab of foie gras in America, there may be 20 contenders. If you ask where to find the best hamburger in America, there are hundreds of contenders and hundreds of people who wish to tell the story, hold their hamburger high and say, "This is mine. This is my place. These are my people. This is my burger."
One of the most popular ways to embellish a burger, at least from some of the recipes in your book, was the onion. And last night, I tried your recipe for onion-entangled griddle burger, where you took the really thinly shaved onions and you smashed them on top of the raw patty, and then you flipped it over and let them get all caramelized before you put cheese on it and put it on your bun with only mustard. And it was really quite good.
Now, we're talking about a very thin burger. I mean, when you were working on that burger you cooked last night, Debbie, you were pushing down hard, caramelizing that meat on the flat top. It wasn't anything about medium rare, right?
No, I smashed it out to where it really wasn't even round. The edges kind of cracked.
Yeah.
Where'd you find that one?
I found that in a little town called El Reno, Oklahoma. In El Reno, there are four or five spots that sell this style of burger. And to enter one of these restaurants is to enter, you know, this cloud of onion smoke and grease, and it's a pleasant place to be.
Now, you have a whole chapter about extended burgers, the way that people use onions or soy meal or whatever to sort of add to the ground beef. My grandfather always used cracker meal.
This is a response to tough times. You know, the kind of burger you're describing is a frugal burger. And I see it mostly in an area not far from where I live here in Oxford, in northeastern Mississippi, and around the towns of Corinth and Boonville. in those towns, in most cases, when you ask for a hamburger, what you're going to get is an extended burger like this. It may be cut with soy. In other cases, they make kind of a slurry that is burger meat, flour, and water, and they cook them like pancakes, and they call those dough burgers.
That just doesn't sound good to me. What does that taste like?
To be frank, I didn't like them either. I didn't like them at all. But how dare I criticize them when the people of Boonville, Mississippi love them? You know, if you've moved away from Boonville and you're coming back home, you want a dough burger. And that's why when people ask me, you know, what's the best burger you had, it's kind of a moot point. And I try to dodge that question as best I can.
Well, that's my question.
I knew it would be. I was trying to cut you.
What is your favorite burger?
So I'm still not going to be able to avoid this question is what you're saying.
No. You can't write a book called Hamburgers and Fries and not tell me what your favorite hamburger is.
I really thought I had this plotted out well.
Forget it.
If forced, and it sounds as if I'm being forced, I would say that my favorite is the pimento cheeseburger. The epicenter of this particular burger camp is Columbia, South Carolina. So you take a flat burger and you slather the bun with pimento cheese, which for those of you who do not know it, is nothing more than a mixture of shredded cheese, mayonnaise, pimento peppers. I like a little bit of sage in mine, a little bit of salt, a little bit of pepper, maybe some green onions. And you put the cold cheese on the hot meat, and it begins to melt. And you get these little swirls and eddies atop the burger as the cheese starts to melt and kind of turns into something kind of gooey and really luscious. And to bite into that as the cheese goes squirting out the other end of the bun is one of the great pleasures. And I like it also because of the lazy man's appeal, which is you keep the pimento cheese in your refrigerator and you don't have to reach for all these different condiments. You've got one thing to slather on your burger, clamp the top bun, and you're done.
Now I want to talk a little bit about condiments. You call for all different kinds of condiments. There's mayonnaise, mustard, salsa verde, even Cheese Whiz. But I don't see ketchup.
I'm not a fan of ketchup. I think it's too sweet. Way too sweet.
Now, I understand that Louie's Lunch in New Haven, which you mentioned is one of the places where they claim to be the original burger, they don't even allow ketchup in the building.
I love those people. I embrace the ideals of Louie Lunch and encourage other people to do the same.
John T. Edge is the author of Hamburgers and Fries, An American Story. He's also the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance at Ole Miss.
That was NPR's Debbie Elliott. Thanks for listening to today's Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. Go to our website, npr.org/kitchenwindow, for more food stories and recipes. Join us next time for a bowl of cold soup. I'm Bonnie Wolfe.